Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of our society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are actually counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines to know who is working against our interests, to understand why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful, it's scary. In our concluding hour, as we have done over now almost 2 years, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah. It means teaching, not law, and it is liberating, not enslaving. And it provides, through its covenant, the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, anytime over the next 3 hours, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, it's 877-376-45. So the question before us is, are you willing to go where the evidence leads? Even if a rational evaluation of that evidence leads to a repudiation of your long-held political and religious beliefs. This morning I'd like to explore the Ukraine. Reuters reported over the weekend that the Ukraine's parliament put the president to flight, that it named a new speaker as acting head of state on Sunday to replace Viktor Yanukovych. Now, it's interesting, of course, President Obama said, you know, I think what we ought to do in the Ukraine, their Uncle Putin, is let the people choose. Let the democratic process play out and let the people speak and tell us who they want. Well, let's look for a political democratic solution. Well, unless I'm mistaken, Yanukovych was elected. He was the person that the people wanted. And that he has been deposed by a minority of the people. A very small minority of Ukrainians filled their independence square. The missing president's abandoned country home is now on display. It has fueled demands that the Russian-backed elected leader and his allies be held to account for their corruption on a grand scale. You know, it was pretty grand. Realization that he had, at least this is the rumor that's coming out of the Ukraine, that he had two bells that were beside his bed. One was for alcohol, the other was for sex. But it is indeed telling that this communist leader would be so lavish in his lifestyle. Remember, the whole concept of communism was from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, and that rather than having elitist, the super rich and the super powerful, the religious dictate terms to the people and rule over them, that the common people would rise up and that we would have people power, that the majority, the 99%ers, would legislate on behalf of the people. But you know, every time that political strategy is deployed, the communist replacements are as vulgar, if not more so, in this case, more so, than those they replaced. It isn't a trade up. It's usually a trade down. Not only do the newly empowered communist leaders live a more indecent, immoral, and self-indulgent lifestyle than did their counterparts, the gap between the leaders and the people is exacerbated because the communist system does not work economically, taking the average person down in terms of economic status. The European Union and Russia vying for influence over the huge former Soviet Republic on their borders consider their next move. The EU officials said that they were ready to help Ukraine, while Russia said that it would keep cash on hold until it sees who's in charge. Yeah, that is half true. The reality is that the Ukrainians are in a horrible position. They just bit off the only hand that was willing to feed them. And so we're going to explore what they did and what the consequence is of not thinking You know, there is a consequence of complaining if you don't have a better option, and they don't have one. The parliament, meantime, appointed security officials and announced legal moves against members of the ousted administration. That's always interesting. That one of the reasons that dictators, and this was a popular elected leader, don't want to resign power, and they don't want to cave in to the alleged grievances of those who protest against them. It's because they know so. They know that if they do, they'll be hunted down like animals. That's what's happening in the Ukraine. You are never going to get the government that is better than the morality of the people when this occurs. CNN reports that U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice warned on Sunday that it would be a grave mistake if Russian President Vladimir Putin intervened militarily in the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Well, if that's true and you're speaking for the Obama administration, you're saying that the United States can intervene militarily in Korea, in Vietnam, in Panama, in Grenada, in Somalia, in Iraq twice, in Afghanistan twice, and in Libya. But Russia cannot intervene in a former state? I suppose if we were to deploy this logic, Obama would have scolded Abraham Lincoln. I did a little research to figure out how bad the situation is in the Ukraine. In 1910, the Ukraine's gross domestic product was 7% of the United States. You know, the Ukraine right now is one-sixth the size of the United States in population. It's an equally desirable slice of land as well in terms of agricultural capability and minerals and access to trade routes and the like. So in 1910, before the Bolshevik Revolution, the GDP was 7% of that of the United States. By 2010, the Ukraine's GDP had shrunk to 1% of the United States. So where's a country, 45 million people, about the same size as France, and their gross domestic product, all those people who were really good at protesting, have an economy that is 1% that of the United States with, you know, approximately one-fifth to one-sixth of the population. The nation has many of the components, according to Wikipedia, of any major European economy. It has very rich farmlands. It has a well-developed industrial base. It has highly trained labor. It has a good education system. At present, however, the economy remains in the doldrums. I began the uprising, reviewing the uprising in Ukraine, with an observation. One that I must say I was ignorant of. Vladimir Putin pointed out that the carnality of the revolts in the Ukraine, which were not peaceful. They were throwing Molotov cocktails. Many of the protesters shot small arms. They burned down the buildings. They destroyed property. This myth that is being promoted by the United States, particularly Susan Rice, that this began as a peaceful protest and that the government was the only aggressor from an aggravated assault perspective is just not true. And so Putin said, you know, they're behaving similarly they did during the pogroms. And so I did some research. And what we find is that the Ukrainian treatment of Jews was the worst in the world. That they led the way, they paved the way, if you will, for what happened throughout Europe in as a consequence of Nazi Germany. They were hunting down and torturing Jews, robbing them, raping them, molesting them in mass. Decades before the concentration camps were built on behalf of Nazi Germany. I also decided that since that had been, for some, too ancient history to look back into the beginnings of the 19th century. So I wanted to see, you know, how is the Jewish population doing in the Ukraine? Well, in 1926, the Jewish population ranked third after Ukrainians and Russians. 6% of the population, 1.6 million Jews lived in Ukraine. Third largest ethnic group, 6% of the total population, 1.6 million. That was in 1926. And that was after the pogroms, where they were killed in the hundreds of thousands by Ukrainians. In 1959, the Jewish population was now ninth in terms of ethnic groups, only represented 2% of Ukrainians, and had fallen by 50% in real terms and by two-thirds as a percentage of the population. 1969 was 777,000, 1.7% of the population. In 1979, 634,000, 1.3%. In 1989, 486,000, 1%. In 2001, the last year we have data, 103,000, 0.2%. For Jews to be involved in a mass exodus, you know, just look at the years between 1989 and 2001, going from just under 500,000 to just above 100,000. Well, 80% almost of the Jews in the country fleeing. Just in, 12 years? There's something very, very bad, evil, occurring in this country for that to have happened. I also want to speak about the IMF, and now that the Ukrainians have bit off the only hand willing to feed them, the Russians, what's the history of the International Monetary Fund and of Europe and the United States trying to prop up the Ukraine? And when we return, we have Glenn on the line, and we're going to get his take on the events in this part of the world. You want to hear how bad the situation is monetarily, economically, from a debt perspective in the Ukraine. Welcome back to Shattering This. Before we consider the history of the IMF and Russians with what is essentially a bankrupt nation, I'd like to hear Glenn's take on the unfolding events in the Ukraine. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Anna. Just to, accentuate the goings on there, I wanted to point out that the SRN News, the top at the beginning of the program, featured the story that it's the anniversary of the Iwo Jima, taking of Iwo Jima. The victory talk spoke of the famous picture on Mount Suribachi,
right?
Which is, and we have the Iwo Jima Memorial in D.C. near the Arlington Cemetery there. Just
which, of course, we know that actually the picture was staged. We never thought, you know.
What I'm trying to say, falls under the heading of, things are not always what they seem, especially when the military's involved, and truth is the first casualty of war.
Right.
And so I just thought that was apropos, given what's been transpiring in the Ukraine.
Right.
Can I
just want to interrupt you for a second? Because on Iwo Jima, I am universally opposed to the way that the U.S. Went about deploying its troops in the Pacific against the Japanese, and it was almost the Ulysses S. Grant strategy of so long as we kill a few of them, it doesn't matter how many of us die, because we have more people than they have. And it was a strategy that just led to the sacrifice of like 1,000 lives for everyone we lost in Pearl Harbor. And I look at that and say, how can that be considered patriotic or moral, that we would sacrifice so many people in revenge for so few? And there's probably no place that is as demonstrable of that as Iwo Jima, which, for all practical purposes, had no real significance in terms of its value. I mean, we gave it up shortly after we took it.
Well, it's Yeah, I mean, it's as ridiculous, pointless as some of the hills that were taken over and over in Vietnam. Take
right.
that hill.
And, perfect analogy. You know, the almost every one of the hills that Americans charged up and died in great numbers and were celebrated, you know, as heroes for charging up the hill. The next day, we would have helicopters pick them up from the top of the hill, pick up the dead and wounded, and we would leave, and you'd say, why did we do that? Because the hill would be recaptured by those we said were enemy. And our strategy is just so bankrupt these days.
Let's do it again. Let's do it again.
You know, how is that heroic? Yeah. You know, climbing, scaling up a hill, forgetting all of the, you know, the strategies of war, that's a really stupid idea. But
yeah,
what's the purpose of taking an island or stranding up a hill and then abandoning it? I don't get it.
No, it's it's just a thing. Sanity, I think, as a casualty of war, you know, surely.
Yes, it is. William, what Thomas Jefferson said. You know, when you know, you read the various consequences of war and having an established military, and while his language is more polite and certainly more refined than mine is, sanity is one of the things he said is very quickly sacrificed, as is morality, as is truth.
Right. So that's a good framework for my next point about the Ukraine. As being a nurse, as there's the medical news, mm-hmm. they were pointing out how the police who were being victimized by the poor, mm-hmm. harmless
right.
cocktails and high-powered rifles of the poor, peaceful dissidents
right.
In Ukraine were not receiving proper medical treatment, or they weren't properly equipped and blah, blah, blah. You know, designed to, you know, reflect poorly on Yanukovych, which I'm not saying he's a good guy or deserves anything
right.
better, but they accentuated the fact that the lack of logistical medical support for the police.
Right.
And they pointed out how quickly the dissidents, having gotten hold of a nearby space of some sort in a building, set up a field hospital. You know, on the other hand, the dissidents set up and I saw like a picture of that, and I saw caps and gowns and masks and gloves,
right.
and I'm thinking, how amazing that these people
right.
living in camping in tents had all this medical equipment with them. That was
right.
just amazing.
Yeah, where did they get it? Of course, they got it from government facilities. But what's amazing too is that I am of the opinion there are no good sides here. I think this is like Syria.
Exactly.
We should just stay off. There's both sides are repulsive here, and
right.
you can't fix repulsive. But you know, the reality is that the dissidents were not peaceful. They were extraordinarily violent, and they captured and killed many police. So, you know, this myth that is being promoted by the United States, I mean, I don't know why the United States doesn't think that truth is ever good enough. Why does it always need to lie to make its point? We'll return. Stay with us, Glenn, when Shattering This continues after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering This. We're reviewing the conditions in the Ukraine. It is all about money. They are bankrupt. It's interesting that the Ukraine is bankrupt with their total debt as a percentage of GDP currently under 40%. I think it's about 35%. It's going to end this year. The estimate is at 41%, be over 50% next year. So it's growing rapidly. But their aggregate debt as a percentage of GDP is currently in the mid-30s, and yet it's not serviceable. And if, no matter how big your debt is as a percentage of gross domestic product, when it becomes unserviceable, you're bankrupt. And that is really the case in the Ukraine. In the United States, where our total debt as a percentage of GDP now is 110 to 115%, so we are very close to 3 to 4 times worse than the Ukraine in real terms. But in the United States, the Federal Reserve came up with this magical potion that pushed bankruptcy down the road a few years, called quantitative easing, where the Fed just simply diluted the money supply by creating the image of having more money and used the imaginary money to buy its own bonds because no one else wanted to buy them. Now, here's the story with the Ukraine. The International Monetary Fund, which used to be primarily the United States, and now it's a mix of the United States and Europe, approved a $2.2 billion extended fund facility, an EFF, with Ukraine in September of 1998. In July of 1999, the three-year program was increased to $2.6 billion. The Ukraine's failure to meet monetary targets and our structural reform commitments caused the EFF of the IMF to suspend the or delay those disbursements on many occasions. The last EFF disbursement was made in September of 2001. So the first attempt by the International Monetary Fund to provide the Ukraine with $2.6 billion in loans failed because the Ukrainians failed to live up to the terms of the agreement. Now, typically, when you, I've been in business before and I've borrowed money from banks. And I got this, I can tell you from experience, that if you don't meet your obligations with the bank, they not only won't loan you any money, they will turn you upside down to shake every loose nickel out of your pocket and drop you like yesterday's newspaper. But not the International Monetary Fund. No, not them. The IMF granted Ukraine a $16.4 billion loan in October of 2008. So after the $2.6 billion loan went bad, and the Ukraine didn't honor any part of its agreements, the IMF granted them 16.4 in October of 2008. This kind of escalation, by the way, is exactly what you would expect in a country that is in a debt spiral, of which the government thus far has received $10.6 billion, at least as of May of 2010. Further payments were frozen after the Ukraine raised minimum wages and they raised pensions, contrary to the IMF recommendations. Now, this is indicative of the dependency culture that has taken over the Ukraine. Now, they came out of the Soviet Union, you know, from each according to their ability, which means no one does diddly squat, and to each according to their need, and everybody is really needy. Well, you come out of that mindset, which is what is being established in the United States. We are becoming also a dependency culture, that people stop working. And then they start feeling entitled. Oh, yeah, I need my Social Security. I need my Medicare. I need the government to provide my food stamps. I need government subsidies. I need the government to offset the rising cost of the things that I need in my life. And you become more and more dependent on a government that has no means to support itself. And so the Ukraine did exactly what they ought not have done. They raised minimum wages for unproductive jobs, and then they raised pensions, which is the single biggest calamity. That's the ultimate final nail in America's coffin, is the federal pensions and Social Security. So in 2010, at that point, the Ukraine was already the third largest borrower from the IMF, third in the world. On July 28th of 2010, the IMF approved. Now, this is a deadbeat country. It had suspended it what it was offering the Ukraine because the Ukraine consistently exacerbated the problem with their economy. And so what does the bankers at the IMF do? Oh, we just love a dependent country, particularly if it's large. Because a dependent country is a country where its people are easy to manipulate and control. So on July 28th of 2010, the IMF approved a 29-month, $15.2 billion loan to the Ukraine. Among others, this led to a 50% increase on household natural gas utility prices for Ukrainian customers, a demand of the IMF. You see, the IMF the Ukrainians have been receiving oil at below market rate from the Russians. And the government has chosen to subsidize the cost of that oil even below the price that they're paying. It is one of the largest contributors to the national debt of the Ukraine. So they let it rise a little bit. On December of 2013, the IMF stated that the Ukrainian government had only partially implemented agreements reached in 2010 with the fund, and in this connection, the program was not going to be further implemented. So now this is the fourth time that the International Monetary Fund has arranged to provide money to the Ukraine, each time the Ukraine has failed to meet its obligations. Now, according to Ukrainian Prime Minister Mykola Azarov, quote, the extremely harsh conditions, oh, can you hear austerity? It sounds like the Greeks, doesn't it? Of a renewed IMF loan. Now, can you imagine? Four times the IMF has provided the money, four times they've reneged on their terms, four times they've been unable to pay back the money, and they don't want any terms attached to it because they're extremely harsh. And now the Ukrainians are going back to the IMF and saying, oh, you need to give us many more billions, but this time without any of those harsh conditions because you can't expect us to be responsible and to pay it back. On the 20th of November of 2013 was the most recent presentation by the IMF, which included big budget cuts. Yeah, you can't spend lavishly. You can't have a dependency government. And 40% increases in natural gas bills to get them at least within shouting distance of the actual cost of the national gas that was being used. It had been the last argument in favor of the U.S. government's decision to suspend preparations for the association agreement between the Ukraine and the European Union. Now, we're all told in the West, and this is what's amazing about this. We're all told in the West that the reason that these 50,000 and later 100,000 Ukrainians out of a population of 45 million, so an insignificant number, decided that they would go and burn things down in the in Independence Square in Kiev was because that dastardly ex-communist leader that was the puppet of Putin decided that he would turn down the integration with the European Union in favor of remaining integrated with Russia. That's what we were told, right? Well, the truth is, it's not that at all. It's that the terms and conditions of borrowing from the International Monetary Fund were unacceptable. And it was the Ukraine saying, we can't live with the terms you're trying to impose for the money that we so desperately need. And it was a direct result of not being able or willing to accept the terms of the loan from the IMF that led to the disassociation with the European Union. The decision to put off signing of this EU-Ukraine association agreement led then to the massive ongoing protests in the Ukraine. But it was all prompted by the IMF's insistence that on for the fifth time that the Ukraine wanted money, that they actually do what they had promised to do. On 10 December, President Yanukovych stated, we will certainly resume the IMF negotiations if there are conditions that suit us, and we will take that path. However, Yanukovych also stated that the conditions put forward by the IMF were unacceptable. He said, I had a conversation with U.S. President Joseph Biden, who told me that the issue of the IMF loan has almost been solved. But I told him that if the conditions remained, we were not interested in such loans. So here's the United States being told and the world being told that this guy was dead set on Russian integration and thwarted the people's desire to be integrated economically and to have opportunities for trading with Europe. It was the last throes, the media said, of the Cold War. Baloney. This was all about the terms imposed by Europe and the United States through the IMF to keep the Ukraine afloat were not acceptable to the Ukrainians. That's the truth. It's, you know, when we had the lead into this news and we had Susan Rice saying that, you know, this was a peaceful uprising by the people and that the government responded violently. If we have to lie about the conditions that exist, including what caused the collapse of the agreement with the European Union, then how is there any chance whatsoever, if the pretexts are so distorted that people are fed lies, how is there any chance whatsoever that a moral, intelligent, rational, productive solution can be deployed? If you have to base your premise on lies, what is the likelihood that your solution will prevail? But that's where we find ourselves in the United States. In December, the Ukraine again applied to the IMF asking for money, approximately $20 billion this time, in order to meet costs incurred due to the signature of the association with the European Union. You see, the government said, okay, you know, the people want us to integrate with the European Union. We'll do so, but you got to pay our way. We need another $20 billion. Well, we're going to consider a Standard & Poor's review of this in a moment. So as the United International Monetary Fund, which would be Europe and the United States, both of which are bankrupt, are being asked to supply another $20 billion to the Ukraine after having been burned in the previous four attempts to loan the Ukraine money, we have this from Standard & Poor's in terms of their evaluation of the Ukraine. The Standard & Poor wrote and released past week, in our view, the political situation in the Ukraine has deteriorated substantially. We believe that this puts the government's capability to meet debt service at increasing risk and raises uncertainty regarding the continued provision of Russian financial support over the course of 2014. No kidding, Sherlock. That was your first clue. We believe that it is likely that the Ukraine will default in absence of significantly favorable changes in circumstances, which we do not anticipate. To default is to be bankrupt. The United States would have defaulted on its debt if it was not for quantitative easing. To be bankrupt is sheer anarchy. That means that your currency becomes worthless. That means your banks are have squandered the savings of those who have made deposits. Now, in America, squandering savings won't be a big deal because the vast majority of Americans have less than $500 in savings and owe over $275,000 on average. So the average American is in debt as opposed to having savings. They went on to say that we are therefore lowering our long-term foreign currency sovereign credit rating on the Ukraine from CCC plus to just plain old CCC. The negative outlook reflects our view that the Ukrainian government has yet to secure sufficient external funding to avoid a default or distressed exchange. This has always been about money in Ukraine. Always about money. And there's two forms of money in our world today. There's the fiat type currency where we're nations are made dependent, and there's citizens based upon debt. If you look at your, if you're an American, you look at your currency, it is a debt instrument. Or in the case of oil, which is now the principal commodity, monetary commodity in the world, in the Ukraine, biggest issue is that they import oil. The negative outlook reflects the view that the government does not have external funding to avoid the default. In the United States, we simply create the illusion of funding by devaluing our currency. In the Ukraine, they don't have that option. The clashes between protesters and security forces, according to Standard & Poor's, that began on February 18, led us to conclude that the conciliatory end of the political standoff is now out of reach. We consider that the future of the current Ukrainian leadership is now more uncertain than any time since the protests began in November. We believe that the Russian government's support for the Ukraine is tied to the current leadership. Yeah, gee, if you've got a group of people who are now have taken control over the popularly elected leadership of the Ukraine, who are demanding that all ties with Russia be severed, you know, it's going to be really hard to encourage the Russians to continue to supply them with oil and with more loans. As a result of the intensifying political turmoil in the Ukraine, we consider that continued Russian support up to the committed $15 billion is increasingly uncertain. It's not uncertain. They know for sure that Russia is not going to supply $15 billion to the Ukraine when the now government in Kiev is saying to hell with Russia. So what's going to happen? Is the IMF going to provide another $20 billion? Is the Ukraine going to accept the terms that were imposed by the West, which is a huge curtailment of the size of the Ukrainian government and its subsidies and its dependencies and its pensions and its wages? And other Russians didn't put such constraints on the Ukrainians. I mean, this thing that is just so unbelievably stupid here is the Russians stepped in and were willing to help without strings attached. Stunning. And they said, hell no. No, boy, we're really got a well-educated group of protesters here. No, no, no. We want to instead be allied with those people who want to impose all sorts of restrictions, those that we have found previously to be wholly unacceptable. Conditions that are not socialistic, that's what we want imposed. Are they kidding themselves? Are they just oblivious? What is wrong with young people today? They lost their mind.